Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Asma Khalid, and this is Radio Boston. Coming up, the latest on the nurses' strike at Tufts Medical Center.
Our nurses are very saddened that they had to come out on the street today to publicize what's going on here at Tufts Medical Center, but we are very proud of who we are and that we advocate for our patients and what they need.
Also today, the president and COO of Boston-based One United Bank on how to fix the racial wealth gap through economic empowerment.
Take your 20, your 30, your 40, your 50, and dedicate to saving some money in a black bank every month and develop your discipline.
And we know why Henry David Thoreau went to Walden.
I went to the woods because I wanted to live deliberately. I wanted to live deep and suck out all the marrow of life. To put to rout all that was not life, and not when I had come to die. Discover that I had not lived.
But turns out there were some other folks in those woods, too. That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Asma Khalid. We'll begin today with the latest on the nurses' strike at Tufts Medical Center, where more than 1,200 nurses walked out this morning. It's the first Boston nurses' strike in more than three decades. The strike follows more than a year of stalled contract talks, which broke down late last night. The nurses and their supporters are rallying outside the hospital. Here's Dorchester State Rep Dan Cullinane.
I will never apologize for standing up for labor. I will never apologize for standing up for working families.
Joining us now in the studio with an update on the strike is WBUR reporter Martha Biebinger. Hi, Martha.
Asma, how are you?
I'm doing all right. So Martha, you were over there at the strike earlier today, and mm-hmm. you got a sense of what's been happening. Could you explain this to me? I mean, how many folks are we talking about, and does this mean that they're essentially not on the job?
Right. So the people who walked out of the overnight shift at 7 a.m. were the last union members to work in the hospital for the day. There are maybe, I don't know exactly, 10 or 15 people who crossed the line, so union members who are on staff.
Okay.
But the union called a one-day strike. The hospital says the strike will last 5 days because that's the terms of the contract signed to bring in the replacement workers. So there's going to be a little bit of a dispute about that tomorrow morning when the union nurses attempt to go back to work. But the scene out there is hundreds of people walking the sidewalks with picket mm-hmm. signs. They've been joined by many union members from the iron workers, SEIU, teachers. The firefighters are driving by and beeping their truck horns. It's quite a scene.
And so, Martha, just so I understand this correctly, you're saying 7 a.m., the nurses who were on duty walked out at that point.
Yes.
Presumably then there were another set of nurses who were scheduled to come in?
That's correct. Their jobs are being done by this team of replacement workers who've come from all over the country.
Oh, from all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, gosh, I guess that's what you have to do when there's a sort of a nursing shortage.
Many of these are very specialized jobs, so they have to look far afield to find women and men who are specialized in neonatal
right
intensive care unit, for example.
Oh, wow. So, Martha, I understand that the contract negotiations broke down, but can you give us the specifics on what are the key sticking points for some of the nurses?
I can give you some specifics, Asma, but it's sort of interesting because there's even a disagreement about what's in dispute.
I see.
So why don't we hear from the nurses' side first? And this is Barbara Tiller. She's a 27-year veteran of Tufts. She's co-chair of the bargaining unit.
We have three sticking points, and all of those need to be dealt with. It's not a shell game where you can give us one thing and blow off the other two. Staffing resources is vital for what we're doing, and we're done with not having those resources when we're trying to take care of patients here. The other two are to help hire and retain nurses that can go anywhere in the city and earn more money and get better benefits.
So you'll hear there, Asma, that the nurses say it's staffing, mm-hmm. wages, and she didn't exactly mention pension, but that is another issue. And that's what the hospital says is the main issue. So
the pensions.
Yeah.
I see.
The chief nursing officer at the hospital, Terry Hudson Jenks, says that they tried to make some concessions in that regard, delaying some pension changes for about 18 months yesterday in the last minute, you know, mm-hmm. leading up to the strike deadline. But that didn't go very well.
It's shocking to me that the MNA didn't even look at our proposal before walking out on us. Very disappointing. The MNA talks about the situation being a staffing issue. It's not a staffing issue. It's a pension issue. It's a money issue.
So there's the summary. The hospital says it's a money issue. Mm-hmm. Nurses, if you ask them to summarize, I think would say it's a staffing issue.
And the truth may be somewhere maybe in the middle or a combination of both?
It's possibly perception, uh-huh. I think there's real disagreement.
You know, do we have a sense when we're talking about pensions what the real dollar amount difference is that's in dispute?
Well, it depends because a certain group of the nurses are still in a fixed pension system where they would get a set amount upon retirement. And most of the nurses have been moved into what's considered a defined contribution system.
I see.
And that's where, you know, like, I think like you and I, Asma, both we get some money yep. from our employer and we invest it in a 401k or a 401(3b), something like that.
Got it.
And so it varies depending on which group of nurses you're talking about. But for both, they feel like the what the hospital's offering is not generous enough.
It's not sufficient. Yeah. Okay. So, Martha, what can we expect to happen from here in terms of further negotiations?
Nothing is scheduled.
Oh, okay.
There is, as you've probably gotten a sense, there's a lot of tension between the two sides. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh is urging both sides to get back at it.
I've been kept up to date by both sides, but I have not been asked to take a formal role. And, you know, I can't force my way into it, but I certainly would love to see this resolved. It certainly doesn't do any good for anybody in the city to having a strike for the first time in 30 years.
So Walsh is, in some strikes, he has taken an even more active role. We'll mm-hmm. wait and see whether he does and whether the sides can find a way to get out of the sort of fervor of the moment mm-hmm. and sit down again.
Martha, how long is this really sustainable, the strike, in terms of care, providing proper care at the hospital?
Well, they haven't contracted with these temporary nurses indefinitely. So the expectation...
5 days, you said.
Yes, the expectation is that the union nurses will return on Monday morning. And
okay.
the hospital has said, you know, we'll welcome them back. We respect the decision that anyone made during this situation. But it feels like it would be it's going to be very tense in there on Monday,
mm-hmm.
To imagine everyone starting to work together again.
So do you have a sense of how long this might last?
Well, I know I can tell you that the nurses and the hospital expect everything to go back to sort of normal on Monday. But if you're asking how long it'll be before they actually have a
yep.
deal, I think that's very hard to predict at this point.
All right. Well, thanks so much. That's Martha Biebinger, WBUR health reporter. Thanks again.
Thank you, Asma.
Recently here on Radio Boston, we reported on a study out of UMass Boston that found 18% of black mortgage applicants were denied loans in Massachusetts. That's compared to only 5% of white applicants. One United Bank is the largest black-owned bank, and it's trying to address some of those discrepancies. It's a Boston-based bank with branches in Miami and L.A. The headquarters are actually down here on Franklin Street in Boston's financial district. In 2016, the bank partnered with rapper and activist Killer Mike to promote minority banking. There was this hashtag that they used, Bank Black. Here's Killer Mike speaking to a crowd about the importance of using financial independence as a political tool.
You don't work for politicians because you don't organize your money. You don't organize your money, so you don't have no lobby groups. You don't have no lobby groups, so you out again. And I'm saying to you right now, the first step to organizing your money as a collective is learning how to organize your money on your
Joining us now is Terry Williams. She's president and chief operating officer of One United Bank. Terry, thanks so much for hopping into the studio and joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me, Asma.
So, Terry, can we begin by having you just tell us a little bit about One United, how it was formed?
Sure. For those of you in Boston, we are the old Boston Bank of Commerce. And actually previous to that, Unity Bank that was founded here in Boston. We then grew that bank through acquisitions of four Black-owned banks around the country, People's in Miami, Founders and Family in L.A., and then we combined all four banks into one and changed our name to One United.
And so right now there's a total of four branches nationwide.
Four banks, actually.
Four banks.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, we have three branches here in Boston. We also have branches in Miami and L.A. So, and in addition to that, we are the first Black-owned internet bank. So we have customers all over the country, you know, Chicago, Houston, Atlanta, but our headquarters is here in Boston.
All right. So, Terry, I'd love to hear from you about your sentiments on what the housing landscape looks like here in Boston. You know, as I just mentioned, we've talked on the show before about the fact that Black folks do have a difficult time receiving mortgages. Their applications are denied more frequently. How big are the discrepancies in home ownership that you see?
Yep. So the discrepancies are large. If you look at the percentage of Black folks here in Boston that have owned their home in comparison to the white population, a significant gap. If you look at the wealth between Black and white Bostonians, you're looking at an average net assets of $700 for Black people in Boston compared to $256,000 for white Bostonian.
That this was is the study. Average, you said net worth.
Yeah, it's net assets.
Net assets.
And that comes
from
a Federal Reserve study called The Color of Wealth in Boston.
Gosh.
So there's a huge gap. And the reason for the gap actually is home ownership and the equity that people have been able to build up in their homes. So there is a significant gap that needs to be addressed.
So, Terry, is it that some families may not be eligible for a mortgage when we talk about the fact that some families aren't able to get a mortgage?
Yep.
Is it that they may not be eligible, actually, to receive that? And if that is the case, what do you think is the right solution in those situations?
Yep. So, yes, there's part of it that's eligibility. Part of it is just the income difference and the need. You know, Boston is a community that has high home values. Prices.
Yep.
And so having the down payment and being able to afford the home is definitely a factor.
Mm-hmm.
There are great programs today that a lot of your listeners need to be aware of.
Like what, for example?
Yep. Yeah. So we actually just became, this is an announcement, a lender for the One Mortgage program that's offered here in Boston to help first-time home buyers and provides down payment assistance.
Mm-hmm.
We're partnering with MAHA, or the Massachusetts Affordable Housing Alliance, to offer that program. We also work with the Boston Home Center, who also provides down payment assistance. So part of it is, yes, that there's an affordability issue, but there are great programs that give down payment assistance for those that, you know, meet the eligibility requirements. So that's part of it. The other part of it is that there is, you know, racism still exists, that there are differences in terms of approval rates for Black versus white borrowers that have similar characteristics. So whether or not they're approved or whether or not the mortgages that they get are the same rate, we see differences. The data shows differences. There is a need for more data to explain those differences. Part of it is, you know, just a difference in terms of racism. Part of it is also credit. What we find at One United Bank is that a lot of times borrowers are declined because of bad credit.
I see.
And that there's a need for the African-American community, as well as other communities, but particularly the African-American community, to focus on rebuilding credit.
Got it. And so it sounds almost a bit like a sort of chicken and egg scenario, because I understand what you're saying about some families not receiving those loans. But in some cases, I can understand why a bank wouldn't want to offer a loan to somebody who does have bad credit, taking away, you know, their race in particular. I mean, I think in some ways we look at what happened in the last decade, right? And when some bankers, I would say, preyed upon people who had lower incomes, they didn't really have a long enough credit history. We saw that, okay, sure, in some ways, you could say they preyed upon these people, but it was actually these low-income families who inevitably ended up losing their homes in those situations.
Yes. And it is a puzzle to some degree that needs to be put together, because there were also families that did qualify mm-hmm. but ended up getting predatory loans.
I see.
So it's really all sides. The banking side needs to do a better job. One United Bank needs to do a better job. But also our community needs to address the credit issues as well as taking advantage of these great programs that are available.
Yeah. You mentioned that somewhat, you know, the housing system, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you sort of suggested, I think, that it is still somewhat discriminatory, right?
Yes.
In terms of take a side, you know, if we have a white applicant and a black applicant with kind of equal applications right in front of us, there's something else going on.
Yes.
Can you talk to me about what else you're seeing?
So, first of all, there is going to be a change in the data that banks collect that will be able to answer this question more statistically.
Okay.
But anecdotally, what we see is that the if someone is on the margin, so a situation where they may have just enough of a down payment, or they have the minimum credit score, or maybe even slightly below, and that there's an exception that needs to be made. In those instances, if you're African American, you are more likely to get declined.
Okay.
So that's really where the difference is. And that the data will show once the data is collected on credit score. But that's what we see anecdotally, is that there is a difference when a judgment is made.
I see.
So,
got it. And so when it comes to the bank itself, I am curious how you sort of upend some of the skepticism that also exists within the community. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll hear from African Americans often that there is this skepticism of the financial sector, that they feel that they have been burned and not treated appropriately as well. Mm-hmm. And do you deal with that from the community's perspective?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, that's one of the great things about the Bank Black movement, because it really has gotten sort of our community to understand that banking is actually for them, you know, and that there's a sense even that, and you know, I hate to use these terms, but, you know, on the air, but there's a sense that, you know, I'll call it their ice is colder. And that, it's a phrase in the Black community, which means that if you're Black, that somehow you're less than.
Okay.
And so whether that's a borrower, if you're a Black borrower, you're less than, whether that's your a bank, whether that's your business, that there's this sense that, you know, in general, if you are in business or if you are a customer, that you're somehow less than. And what this Bank Black movement has done and this Buy Black movement has done is said, no, wait a minute. The Black community spends $1.2 trillion a year. That those are statistics from Nielsen.
Yeah, and sort the question, of consumer spending, you're
consumer
saying.
Spending. Okay. And how do we take that $1.2 trillion and channel that to build wealth in our communities? Mm-hmm. How do we focus on, you know, banking Black, buying Black, you know, using our collective economic spending power to buy the Black? And so those are the things that this movement has really focused the community on. And it has been a real changer in terms of the mindset of our community.
Terry, I imagine that it is really uplifting for people within the African-American community, but have you received any pushback? I mean, I recognize that broadly nowadays there is a lot of pushback. People question this idea of identity politics. And One United, you all have said that you are committed to being authentically and unapologetically Black.
Yep.
What do you mean by that? And have you received pushback?
Mm-hmm. Well, what I will say is that we have more received more love than pushback,
right.
And that people are very proud of the fact that there is a black owned, that there are black owned banks, and that they can do business with people that look like them.
Hmm.
The pushback has really been very minor. We do once in a while get a question of, first of all, are you really black?
Mm.
You know, people and I always pop out and say, yes, look, I'm black, you know, because I am the owner as well as the president.
Yeah.
So, or they'll, you know, they'll ask a question of, are we FDIC insured?
And, okay.
You know, things that go to credibility. And we're like, yes, we are FDIC insured.
Oh, interesting.
So
okay.
There are things like that. There are also, you know, I think really important questions for us as to what are you doing for the community?
Mm-hmm.
And those are the things that we'll talk about, the wonderful things we're doing, but we also talk about how we need to get better. And that by banking with us, by getting a home loan with us, by, you know, doing business with us, that helps us get better.
Got it. And folks, if you're just tuning in, we're talking about One United Bank with the president and chief operating officer, Terry Williams. Terry, you know, I understand what you're saying in terms of sort of that trust within the community and needing to build some of that. Have you found that to be a challenge, particularly because Do you feel that the sort of the problems that you're describing can be addressed solely with free market solutions? I mean, we're talking about sort of the mortgage issue here, but then we can talk about the median household income. We can talk about the high unemployment rate, particularly among young African-American men. So if there are so many other systemic economic problems, to what degree can these sort of free market solutions really be the solution?
Yeah. So no, I actually think it cannot just be private market or public. It really has to be a partnership between the public and private markets.
Okay.
So as an example, these first-time homebuyer programs, the down payment assistance is provided with public funds.
Yep.
And
okay.
It's a grant that's given and paid back when a home is sold. So it is money that's given to support a down payment that's a grant to the borrower. But when the borrower sells the home at a later date, the money is paid back. So the bank offers the loan with private money. That's what we do. But there's public funds to provide down payment assistance. There is also a need for this. You know, I'll look at any city, but say the city of Boston to really address income inequality.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a countrywide decision, but, you know, Boston is the number one city in the country for income inequality.
And you can go to certain neighborhoods and see that there were no mortgage applications accepted from African-American
right. Exactly.
families.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So there is a need for us collectively to address these problems. And so what we're trying to do is figure out the way that we can contribute to mm-hmm. the solutions. And we're making some progress.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Terry.
No, thank you for having me, Asma.
That's Terry Williams. She's the president and COO of One United Bank. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Asma Khalid, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Asma Khalid. And it is time now for our weekly sports segment with Bill Littlefield. He's the host of NPR's Only a Game. Bill, thanks for joining us on Radio Boston.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
All right. Well, Bill, let's start with tennis. And this is actually a sport I do happen to know a thing or two about. There are only 4 days left in the Wimbledon tennis tournament. Can you kind of give me a recap? What's been the highlight in your mind this year?
First of all, I want to congratulate you on saying Wimbledon.
Yeah.
Bud Collins years ago corrected me when I said Wimbledon, and everybody else says Wimbledon.
Wimbledon.
It's Wimbledon. So good.
Thank you.
Everybody's going to have their own choice of highlights. For me, the highlight was set up when it became apparent that Serena Williams would not be playing because she's busy getting ready to have a baby.
She's having a baby, I know.
And Venus Williams came into the tournament as something like 10th ranked or seeded, and all of a sudden is making people wonder if she can win another mm-hmm. Wimbledon singles title.
I think that's unbelievable
very exciting.
In terms of just her athletic prowess, right? You know, Bill, I actually went years ago to Wimbledon. I stood in line, as you could do. You can stand in that queue and just line up and get mm-hmm. tickets the day of, which is pretty amazing at this big sporting event. And I got to see Venus Williams in action. This was probably a decade ago. And she was still, you know, really playing phenomenally. She is now 37 years old. I was reading that three of her most recent opponents in this year's tournament were born in 1997. That's the year that she first started playing at Wimbledon. I mean, isn't that kind of surreal? And I want to play something actually for you real quick, Bill. This is Venus Williams reflecting on her age at the quarterfinal press conference.
I definitely think experience helps, for sure. You know, for a lot of the players I've played, it's their first time in the third round or the quarterfinals or whichever fourth round, so I have an opportunity to bank on experience and having dealt with those sort of pressures before.
Bill, how does her experience help, you know, particularly in a game like tennis?
I'm sure it does. I would be the last person in the world to try to contradict somebody like Venus Williams with regard to tennis. However, it's also nice to have 24-year-old legs rather than 37-year-old legs when you're playing a long match. I'm rooting for her.
Yeah.
I hope she can pull it off. She's going to have to play two more younger players, and it'll be a long climb, but I'm pulling for her.
All right. Now, Bill, the organizers of the Wimbledon tennis tournament have been accused of what has been described as, quote, sexist scheduling. Mm-hmm. What's going on there?
Well, first of all, it's not the first time that it's happened. Mm-hmm. Years ago, I had an opportunity to speak very briefly with Serena Williams when she was in New England to play in one of those team tennis events.
Very cool.
And this was at a point where Wimbledon had announced, or I should say acknowledged, that they were scheduling women's matches in some instances according to the attractiveness of the women.
Oh, my God.
And I put that question to Serena Williams, and I said, what do you think about that? And God bless her, she looked at me, she indicated her own physique with her hands and said, what could be more attractive? And that was, it was a, I love it when somebody fights stupidity and sexism with a sense of humor, among other weapons. So I thought that was terrific. It surfaced again, the idea that the people organizing things at Wimbledon have a better idea than anybody else about who fans want to see, and they shuffle people accordingly on the court, and women get shortchanged.
So it's kind of a supply and demand problem.
Yeah,
maybe.
It's a perception of supply and demand. As I said, I myself would rather watch Venus Williams or Serena Williams play tennis than an awful lot of the men who were playing in the same tournaments. But that's, you know, it's all a matter of, I guess, subjective preference.
Yeah. All right. Well, Bill, let's move from the grass court then to the baseball field. The MLB annual All-Star game was held last night, but on Monday night there was the Home Run Derby.
There it is. Ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, drop the bat.
Aaron Judge, your 2017
Aaron Judge, an outfielder for the New York Yankees, defeated the Minnesota Twins' Miguel Sano. Judge hit a total of 47 home runs in the Derby, and the furthest of the night at 513 feet. But Judge is not the only one hitting homers this year. I know, Bill, as of last weekend, the MLB is on pace to reach 6,117 home runs this season. That would beat the record set in 2000. That was in the era before steroid testing. And I just want to share with you one last stat. I was reading that in June alone, players hit 1,101 balls out of the park. That is the most in a month ever in baseball history. What is going on?
Well, in order to bring even more attention to global warming, I'm going to blame global warming. am I okay doing that? There are as many explanations as there are people you look to for an explanation. Some people say the ball is wound tighter and the seams are lower. Pitchers have complained about that. Some pitchers have said the umpires have changed the strike zone a little bit and they're forcing them to go a little higher in the strike zone, which puts the ball in a place where a hitter is more likely to hit it out.
No chemicals going on?
Haven't heard any charges of that. Most of what I've heard in terms of, you know, hanky-panky,
yeah.
One kind or another, has to do with the baseball being juiced rather than the players being juiced. But I suppose if this keeps up, we'll hear that somebody's developed something that makes them hit the ball further and that science has not yet figured out a test to identify.
I see. But let's pivot real quick to another sport. Tomorrow, 156 women golfers will compete in the U.S. Women's Open. Mm-hmm. The tournament is being held this year at the Trump National Golf Club in Bedminster, New Jersey, that is otherwise known as the Summer White House. The buildings and the golf courses are, of course, owned and frequently occupied by President Donald Trump. Do you expect the president to make a cameo?
I really hope not. I really hope he'll stay away and let the tournament be the focus of attention for the weekend. But he certainly has shown a penchant for the spotlight. And my worry is that if he does show up, he'll say something as silly as some of the things he said to female golfers in the past. And I'd hate to see that happen again.
Yeah, and in terms of one of those comments, I was reading that he made an appearance last week at the LPGA in Wisconsin. And there, according to the New York Times, he told the former women's number one player, Christy Kerr, that essentially he was impressed by what he saw, but then, quote, you girls look heavier on TV. Has there been any opposition from players about this tournament being held on a Trump property?
Yeah, there have been some women who have spoken up and said they wish that the tournament was not being held on a Trump property. And a number of them have spoken up and said they hope the president doesn't show up because, for precisely the reason that I referred to before, they would very much like to have golf, and more specifically women's golf, be the focus this weekend rather than Donald Trump showing up to steal the spotlight.
Got it. Finally, Bill, what can we expect to hear on your show on Only a Game this weekend?
Well, I got a chance to talk to a former Yale rower named Michael Danziger, and he has a unique qualification to talk about his sport. I think we have a little bit of a cut from that.
The coach, Dave Vogel, said, "I want to talk to you. I want to let you know that I've been coaching for 17 years at Yale. And before that, I rowed and I was in the Olympics, and I've seen a lot of rowers come through this program. And of all the rowers who have ever rowed at Yale, you are by orders of magnitude the worst."
Now, that was followed up by, "However, you're better than all the guys who quit."
So don't be a quitter.
So if you want to hear more from Michael Danziger, and I really hope you will, tune us in this weekend.
All right. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
That's Bill Littlefield. He's the host of NPR's Only a Game each Saturday on WBUR at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. The state of Rhode Island's $75 million investment in a video game company owned by former Red Sox pitcher Curt Schilling is widely viewed as one of the worst financial decisions in the history of the state. In the fallout from that investment, the state severed its relationship with the company that was its financial advisor in the deal. But as reporter Ian Donis explains, a recent review shows the company has continued a lot of government business in the Ocean State.
Back in 2010, the Great Recession was hammering Rhode Island. The state was desperate for jobs. In hopes of sparking a new economic sector, Rhode Island lured Curt Schilling's video game company, 38 Studios, with a $75 million state-backed loan guarantee.
"We are no longer slaves to the whims of fate."
That's from the only game produced by 38 Studios, Kingdoms of Amalur: Reckoning. After making that game, 38 Studios went bankrupt in 2012. That left Rhode Island taxpayers on the hook for a total of $88 million. A company called First Southwest was the financial advisor for the state of Rhode Island. It worked with the state's Economic Development Agency on the 38 Studios deal. The state responded by filing a lawsuit accusing First Southwest and other defendants of negligence. The lawsuit alleged they withheld key details about how 38 Studios would run out of money before achieving its business plan.
"It was not appropriate for the state to continue its relationship with First Southwest."
That's Rhode Island Treasurer Seth Magaziner. He led a move to replace First Southwest as the state's financial advisor in 2015. Magaziner said it didn't make sense to keep doing business with a company being sued over the state's misadventure with 38 Studios. Despite that, First Southwest has served as the financial advisor for one-third of Rhode Island's cities and towns since 2014, according to a review by the New England News Collaborative. The company, now known as Hilltop Securities, has also worked as a financial advisor for seven quasi-public Rhode Island state agencies in recent years, on bond issues encompassing tens of millions of dollars. Hilltop Securities has been involved with at least two big proposals with uncertain impacts for taxpayers. The company developed a request for proposals, or RFP, for an unrealized plan to regionalize Providence's water supply. And Hilltop advised the city of Pawtucket on its debt for a proposed new stadium for the Boston Red Sox top minor league team, the Paw Sox. Pawtucket and the state would borrow a combined $38 million to help pay for the stadium.
"I think it puts the taxpayer on the hook for private ventures profits."
That's the Republican leader in the Rhode Island House of Representatives, Patricia Morgan. Morgan is dumbfounded that the same fiscal advisor that worked for the state on the 38 Studios deal has a connection to the envisioned Paw Sox Stadium.
"It's ludicrous, isn't it? The state is now basing a financial decision on a firm that they no longer will do business with because that firm gave them bad advice before. It's ludicrous."
A court has never determined if the company now known as Hilltop Securities gave Rhode Island bad advice on 38 Studios. In February, Hilltop became the last in a series of defendants to make a settlement in the state's lawsuit. The Dallas-based company agreed to pay $16 million without acknowledging any liability or wrongdoing. Hilltop Securities does business in 17 states, including Connecticut and Massachusetts. The company did not respond to multiple requests for comment for this story. Pawtucket Mayor Don Grebian doesn't draw a connection between 38 Studios and the work done by Hilltop Securities.
The deal of 38 Studios was more about economic development and bad decisions. You know, I don't believe that they impact that economic development value, if you will, or that decision. They were given the numbers, and then the powers to be made the decisions based on some of the information.
Grebian credits Hilltop Securities with helping to improve Pawtucket's bond rating. Grebian says Pawtucket has not considered hiring a different financial advisor since he took office, and he's not aware of any Rhode Island communities cutting ties with Hilltop Securities since 38 Studios went bust.
Nobody has ever brought up, you know, I'm not going with Southwest because, or Hilltop because of. I've never heard that. You know, they're still very involved and very respected throughout the state.
Rhode Island Treasurer Seth Magaziner sees the issue differently. He says he was amazed by how many important contracts across state government were renewed without going out to bid.
I don't know how often that has been the case for financial advisors at the municipal level, but I wouldn't be shocked if that's an issue as well, that some of these relationships have existed for decades and just haven't been put out for a publicly competitive bid in a long time.
It took the meltdown of 38 Studios to cause the state of Rhode Island to sever its ties with the company now known as Hilltop Securities. Whether other government entities in the state will now cast a wider net for their financial advice remains an open question.
That story comes from Ian Donis with the New England News Collaborative. And stay with us. Coming up on the 200th anniversary of Thoreau's birth, we look at the forgotten people who also lived at Walden Pond. I'm Asma Khalid, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Asma Khalid.
I went to the woods because I wanted to live deliberately. I wanted to live deep and suck out all the marrow of life. To put to rout all that was not life, and not when I had come to die, discover that I had not lived.
That's Robert Sean Leonard as Neil in the movie Dead Poets Society, reading one of the most famous lines of Henry David Thoreau's book, Walden. In it, Thoreau talks about the woods by Walden Pond as a place where a simpler, more honest life was possible. But for some other folks, those same woods were the only place a life was possible. They were home. These woods were home to the social outcasts from Concord. Here's how historian and Thoreau biographer Laura Walls put it.
It was an area that you could go and squat on the land, live out a life on the margins of society without anybody minding too much. It was, if you will, on the wrong side of the railroad tracks. So to know that about Walden tells us something about Thoreau's intent in going to Walden to become a part of that community in a real way.
But while we remember Thoreau on the 200th anniversary of his birth, we have largely forgotten the other members of that Walden community, the African Americans and the Irish, who also lived by that pond before Thoreau and even alongside him. Elise Lemire is trying to revive that history. She is professor of literature at Purchase College and the author of Black Walden, Slavery and Its Aftermath in Concord, Massachusetts. Elise, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So, Elise, you grew up in Lincoln, right, about a mile and a half away from Walden Pond, but you didn't even know this history until your now husband, who's African-American, took you there and you all somehow discovered this. Is that right?
That is true, and I hate date myself, but I did go to the public school in Lincoln during the 1970s when local Black history was not part of the curriculum.
Okay.
And so I was unaware that there was slavery in Massachusetts, as embarrassing as it is to say, until I was in graduate school and Thoreau introduced me to that history in his chapter on the former inhabitants and winter visitors.
Got it. And how did you discover these stories? Was it by reading that portion in his book?
Well, that's really the incredible part. Thoreau is very specific about three of the different households that were in Walden Woods prior to him moving there.
Uh-huh.
And he gives enough detail that I was able to take those names and some of those stories, and I thought of them as kinds of threads that I would pull in various archives. And from there, I was able to unearth not as much information as I would like. So much of this history has been forgotten. And of course, so many of the people who write history are white people. So I never, in fact, found, for example, a diary or a letter written by one of the people who had lived in Walden Woods. But Thoreau really was the turnkey for me in the archives.
Okay. So can you tell us about some of the specific African Americans who you discovered did live in Walden Woods?
Yeah. And first of all, let me just say that one of the things that strikes me and that others might be interested to think about when they reread Thoreau's book is that he's really working hard to situate the location of his cabin site within the middle of this enclave. I'll call it an enclave, but
That's so interesting. I think I need to reread it because I never picked up on that, to be honest.
Well, you know, it's a chapter scholars don't talk about a lot, and we can get into that maybe later. Thoreau does some really tricky things there with wordplay. It's quite a difficult chapter to read in some ways.
Okay.
But he does situate the site of his cabin very specifically in the midst of these three other former home sites. So, for example, he talks at length about a formerly enslaved man in Concord named Brister Freeman.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about the fact that Brister Freeman was formerly owned by Squire Cumming. Well, I had never heard of Squire Cumming, despite having grown up in the area and thinking I was a good scholar of 18th and 19th century American history. And, you know, frankly, if Emerson and Hawthorne and Bronson and Louisa Alcott hadn't moved to Concord, we would all know who Squire Cumming was because he was probably the most important person in Concord before Emerson became so famous. Squire Cumming is one of the founders of Harvard Medical School. In his will, for example, you know, in his will, he left quite a bit of money. He didn't have any surviving children, so he was a very wealthy man and left money to Harvard specifically for a professor of physic. So Thoreau, you know, provides the names of the former enslavers. He provides lots of hints about the kind of work that people do or did rather. So at one point, for example, he'll tell you in Walden that he wanted to know more about Brister Freeman and another former enslaver who lived there, a man named Cato Ingraham. But all he could discover was, quote unquote, that Brister and Cato pulled wool.
Okay.
So one of the things they did, for example, to survive was work in the local slaughtering industry, pulling wool out of sheep. But, of course, Thoreau's also playing on words there because what he also means when he says they pulled wool was that they pretended to tip their hat to white people when white people passed by in a sign of deference. But, of course, when you pull the wool over someone's eyes, you're also tricking them. So the reason the chapter is sort of difficult is because of these kinds of these plays on words that Thoreau is noted for. I mean, Walden is in many ways a very, very funny book. By pulling all these threads, you can sort of figure out that we're talking about people who lived on tiny, tiny slivers of land. I mean, Brister is the only man who owned, the only formerly enslaved person who owned land in Walden Woods. And he had an acre of, quote unquote, old field. Well, you can't raise a family on an acre of old field in a subsistence economy. Mm-hmm. That's not enough land to raise protein for your family. So,
in addition to Brister, did you discover stories of other families who were living there or other individuals?
There was a woman named Zilpa White, who my research shows is most likely Brister Freeman's sister.
Okay.
She had been enslaved nearby at the Codman Estate, which many of your listeners probably have heard of. It's in Lincoln. But because Lincoln split off from Concord, we don't think of the Codman Estate and Walden Woods as being directly linked. But they're linked in part because so many of the former slaves at the Codman Estate later, when they were abandoned to their freedom, squatted in Walden Woods, which of course is right next door,
right?
So that's a sort of false boundary in our heads. So Zilpa White had formerly been enslaved on the Codman Estate. She squatted on the edge of the road, the border of the road being public space, and probably eked out a living as a spinner. That's what Thoreau tells us, and as a basket maker. And she lived to be 82 years old. And she, in my mind, and I in Thoreau's mind too, she's a very heroic figure because so many women who'd been enslaved in Massachusetts were unable to move out of the houses where they'd been enslaved, and their status didn't really change. Right, the 1790 census says there are no more enslaved people in Massachusetts, but But women and older men weren't moving out of these households and were essentially their lives continued as they had been. So she moves out on her own. She makes a go of it. As a result, she's harassed. Thoreau tells a story in Walden about her house being burned down. She was a victim of arson.
Because of the color of her skin?
It seems from my research that in part, this has to do with her brother. When her brother's widowed, he moves to Walden Woods with his wife, Fenda Freeman. And when Fenda dies, Brister invites into his home another impoverished person in the neighborhood. You mentioned at the top of the program that this was an enclave of formerly enslaved people, but also of the Irish, the poor Irish. So when Brister's widowed, he invites another widowed woman in the area to move in with him. She's white. And some of the harassment that we see happens at around that same time. So I think it might have to do with that there was quite a bit of consternation in the community about that interracial relationship.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, I want you to take a listen to Elise Lemire. We're talking about the forgotten people of Walden Woods. Elise is a professor of literature at Purchase College. Elise, do you have a sense of when and why these people eventually left the woods around Walden?
I do. And it's not a pretty story. And it really is striking to me how much of a connection there is between the story you had at the top of the hour. One of the things Thoreau asked us in Walden, he says, this small village, and he's talking about the Walden enclave, this small village, germ of something more, why did it fail while Concord keeps its ground? So he's asking us the same question we need to be asking ourselves now about segregation and sort of these patterns that we continue to see. So why did this little village in Walden Woods, why did it not succeed? Why, when Brister died and then his grandson died, was that the end of a little village that at one point had 15 people, 15 African-American people living in it? And it has to do with the size of their land. It has to do with the fact that Walden was left wooded because the soil is sandy. So you can't grow food on it. You can't crop on it. So that had a lot to do with it. And then also, the marriage patterns in Massachusetts, again, I mean, I talked about Brister sort of having to deal with a certain amount of harassment because he did in his second relationship become involved with a white woman. And then the kinds of jobs that people could get, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, everything really conspires against them. And frankly, what I talk about in the book is how many of the children in the community died of malnutrition. It's quite a heartbreaking story. But having said that, it is so important to also notice that for Thoreau, he understood the difficulties they encountered and he did regard them as heroic. And that was one of the reasons in his book he wanted to memorialize them at the same time as I think he's also cautioning us in the book not to romanticize them, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's easy to sort of look at figures in the past and say, like, wow, that's a great story, but I don't want to live next to, Brister Freeman.
Mm-hmm.
So he's cautioning us against romanticizing them, but at the same time, he compares Brister Freeman at one point to Scipio Africanus, the great general who defeated Hannibal. So it's a story about segregated patterns in Concord and the fact that this community ultimately was not able to get a toehold. But in the meantime, the persistence that they showed and the fact that Zilpah White, just to take one example, was able to live into her 80s.
In this community, yeah.
Is incredible.
So, Elise, I've read Walden, and I don't recall Thoreau sort of explicitly acknowledging this community as being an enclave for the black community, unless I have forgotten that, which is totally plausible. Did he explicitly talk about this in terms of the racial context?
Oh, absolutely.
And
this is not the chapter that professors and teachers pull out of the book to teach. If you're a high school teacher and you need to teach Walden, you're not going to maybe teach the whole book. So you're going to pull out some chapters. And this probably isn't going to be the one you're going to pull out. Although, having said that, now that we have all this other research, I think it teaches really well. He's quite clear in the beginning that what he's looking at when he walks around in the woods in terms of the surviving built environment is a black community. And he talks about it in terms of race. He's really clear on that.
Uh-huh. You mentioned briefly there the Irish community as well, and I'd love to just circle back on that. Do you have a sense of why some Irish families also moved to the woods? It seems like the woods were this common place where a number of somewhat outcasts, you could say, have conquered, found a safe haven.
Well, to be completely clear, the enclave that I'm talking about with mm-hmm. the formerly enslaved people, that came to an end by 1822. And, of course, the Irish come a little bit later. So at that point, you know, but still some of the same factors are in play. And I should mention that if you've driven through Walden Woods, right, on route, what is that, route 126, right, Walden Road, it's a busy road and it's hard to park and cross the street and get to the pond. When Concord was founded, that was a path. But over time, as Massachusetts became more and more settled, that became what was known as the Great County Road. It was the major thoroughfare to get from Concord into Boston. When a new bridge goes into that connects Charlestown to Boston in 1785.
We have about just 10 seconds left.
Oh, yeah. The Walden Road reverts to what Thoreau calls a humble road. And so to the extent that people live there like the Irish, it's because it was out of the way and the selectmen didn't mind having shanties there.
All right. Well, thank you, Elise.
Thanks for having me.
That's Elise Lemire. She's professor of literature at Purchase College and the author of Black Walden, Slavery and Its Aftermath in Concord, Massachusetts. And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Asma Khalid, and this is Radio Boston.